The podcast you are about to listen to discusses comic books and comic book related media. Be warned, the following will review art, plot, and themes, and will therefore contain spoilers of the materials discussed. Welcome to Comics League International. To episode 9 of Comics League International. I am Brent from DeadlyTroubadour.com. And today, I have a guest, as always. Guest, who are you?
Hello, Brent. My name is Sean Polite. I'm originally from Brunswick, Georgia, and I'm actually living in Athens, Georgia right now. I'm actually a good friend of one of your most recent guests, Mr. Derek Adams, author of Spellsort and The Riddle Box, out in stores now.
He's going to love the plug. Now, we've met a few times, but we don't really know each other. We were kind of like ships in the night. I think roughly within the same time frame as I was leaving Athens, you were coming in.
That's right.
And one of the things, I met you when I was visiting folks in Athens, one of the things we clicked on just almost immediately is, can we say it together?
Go ahead.
3, 2, 1. Scott Summers. Okay. Well, close enough.
Let's do it one more time.
Okay. 3, 2, 1. Scott Summers. I'm going to blame the Skype delay.
That's a...
So one thing I like to ask all my guests is, how did you get into comics?
Oh, fantastic question, Brett. Well, how I got into it was when I was a wee Sean. There was a magical place called the Jiffy's, called the Jiffy Mart.
Jiffy Mart. Mm.
And I remember that my dad actually worked out of Brunswick. He worked on a golf course on Sea Island, St. Simon's Island.
Okay.
And so usually like on Saturday mornings he would take me to my babysitter, but he would always stop by Jiffy and get himself like a coffee, and there would always be like a rack of comics.
Yeah.
Now, and ironically enough, my first exposure was like to DC. I remember there was some Batman and some Green Lantern and Green Lantern Corps, which I really got into.
And then, being
in that Saturday morning cartoon era, you know, you had like Challenge of the Super Friends, there was Spider-Man and his Amazing Friends, the unintentionally but masterfully hilarious Pride of the X-Men one shot.
Oh, that's beautiful. I love that.
just
sheer joy for Pride of the X-Men.
Totally. You know, and of course in subsequent series and all. And so eventually I got into Marvel, you know, through Spider-Man and Iron Man, and in interest of our mutual object of admiration, who has been through so many changes. Well, I remember that I actually went to a supermarket. It was like back in, I think, 1990, 1991, and there was an issue of Uncanny X-Men. And it was 274. And it was one of the Extinction Agenda issues, and it was like I think Jim Lee did the artwork on it. I remember on the cover it had Wolverine, you know, with his mask off, and he had the brown and yellow costume.
Yeah, yeah.
Cable was holding his prototypical big gun.
I know exactly the cover, and I think Storm's on it.
Yeah, that's right. And she was, and I think she was just, and in fact, in the issue, at the end of the issue, she uses her powers on Cyclops, and she was, and Genosha had, and I think the Genosians, or rather, Cameron Hodge, had her, like, had her, made her into a mutate.
Yeah, and so, and, like, on and the that's cover- what grew her up from being little kid no power storm to back to adult with power storm.
Exactly. So it was just, it was just a dynamite issue, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, it just like, oh, and it was just, it really drew me into the world. Of course, you know, I had to catch up, and that's been a really happy experience of conversations and encounters like we had, you know, which, and that was so much fun getting to meet you, you know, all those times, few as they may be.
Yeah. Yeah.
Know, that's helped me keep me entrenched, you know? So when told me about, you know, doing, you know, about doing this interview, I was like, okay, this is wonderful.
See, I was what we're going to talk about today is the X Factor Volume 1, namely issues 10 through, I think, 15.
That's right.
10 through 15, which the reason I chose those, and I was kind of surprised you haven't read them before, is because, I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on in these issues, but a key storyline that runs through them is Scott Summers.
Yes.
Scott Summers just, wow. Like, I'm just trying, it just hit me in my head right now. Can you hear my birds in the background? I don't know.
I can. The birds are awesome. The birds are happy. They are also Cyclops supporters.
They're just Scott saying, Summers. Tell us more about Cyclops. One thing that just hit me about these issues as we're talking is, these stories are they came out in 86, penciled by Walter Simonson, and storyline scripted by Louise Simonson. And there's one issue also that's Silvestri, Mark Silvestri doing the pencils.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And and just, these are not decompressed storyline. Like 86, they were still kind of a bit, they weren't like 60s fast paced, but I mean, these are some meaty stories, and I can't think, this is five issues, and how much happens in these five issues. Can you imagine if they were written today?
Oh my gosh.
This would be 2 years of storylines, I feel. And, Okay. So do you want to give the background? Do you want me to give the background? How do we do this?
I tell you what, you know what, you are the kind host, so I tell you, why don't you lead in and I might fill any gaps with me.
All right. So in, this is the whole background of both X-Factor in general and this storyline we're getting up to. Out of nowhere, the thought dead Jean Grey, who, you know, died as Phoenix, was found by the Fantastic Four, which served as a reason for the original five X-Men. Cyclops, Beast, Marvel Girl, Iceman, and did I say Cyclops? I can't even remember now.
No, you did say Cyclops.
An Angel. Angel. Yep. I left out Angel. Ah, curses. to get together and be X-Men. But not. They're X-Factor. And I'm going to leave out the whole X-Factor, X-Terminators storyline for now.
That's good.
It's kind of a part of it, but it doesn't really play into these issues so much. So I'm just gonna put it aside and kind of wave at it. And one of the things that Cyclops left behind to rejoin X-Factor was his wife Madeline Pryor, who looks a remarkably much like Jean, and his son Nathan Christopher Summers. So he leaves them behind, and they're doing the X Factor thing. The other, all the guys on the team know about this, but they've agreed to not tell Jean and let Scott kind of let her know what's going on at his own pace. This is causing some friction because we're 10 issues into it. And at the start of issue 10, it's the tail end of the mutant massacre.
Yes.
And since I think you said before, well, maybe we were rolling, I had problems with the tech, but you said that you had recently read the Mutant Massacre trade?
This was actually like Mutant Massacre. Oh gosh, it was actually a while back when. Yes. Yeah. It was a real, you know, Mutant Massacre was like, I read it. It was a good while ago, but but so catching up with it. So going into issue 10, it was like, it brought me back into it because I recall, is it okay if I go into Angel?
Oh yeah, go. Of course. Because that also plays into Scott Summers as Guilt.
Indeed. And coming off of like the in Mutant Massacre, the Morlocks, of course, the subterranean mutant community are being taken down. They're being taken down like one by one by a group known as the Marauders.
Yeah, and this was the Marauders' first real outing.
That's right. And some of their roster had included Vertigo, Sabretooth.
Scalphunter.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. X-Factor is, if I can get this correct, X-Factor decides to try to help the Morlocks, but inevitably, you know, there are a number of fatalities, mm-hmm. and there's one moment where Artie, who X Factor's taken in their care, is almost about to be killed, mm-hmm. and so in an act of valor. Angel finds him and tries to protect him, and ultimately the Morlocks end up holding Angel, and Angel has Artie.
Yeah, the Marauders end up taking Angel so Artie can get away.
That's right. Yeah. And so the Marauders end up damaging Angel's wings beyond repair.
Yeah.
And so even in these, and in fact, in this run, through 10 and 15, there are some doctors, find out that his wings have essentially been shattered.
Yeah. Cause they're hollow bones like birds.
Exactly. Yeah. And the problem is that gangrene is setting in, and if Angel, as he wishes, keeps his wings, he's going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a bit of a technicality there's a legal loophole that the doctors find out about, and his wings end up getting amputated.
Yeah, and we didn't even read the issue where the wings got injured, but it's still it's stuck in my mind, just mm-hmm. Angel being thrown against the wall and the spears shoved into the wings, and you know, he's just like doing the thought bubble, which was the style of the times.
Yes.
Of like, you know, he's basically saying scream, make a good show of it, keep himself like the focus of attention so the kids can get away. And it's amazing.
And one of the
this kind of deals in with Scott Summers is, you know, he's always been the field captain of pretty much whatever team he's been on.
Indeed.
Except he feels that in that situation, he made some bad calls. He let personal feelings kind of split the team. He wanted to do something. Angel and Jean wanted to do another. And true. He let the team get split. So this whole time where, you know, over these six issues, other than issue 10, I think issue 11 is when Angel goes to the hospital. But
that's
Scott
right.
is just tore up also with the kind of guilt and grief that none of the thing happening to Warren, Angel, would be happening if he had done his job better. If Scott had not messed up.
Definitely. So right, and Scott is a and ironically enough, and Scott digging into just really just kind of hitting himself hard, you know, with this flaw, it makes his character shine like the brightest because he has such a sense of duty, and he has such a sense of duty and accountability. Although he knows that there's the issue with Madeline and Nathan, although there is always that undying attraction to Jean, especially with her having returned, Madeline being her very likeness, he knows that he has a mission out there, and he's man enough to admit, man, whatever you like to call it, but he's bold enough to admit that he's failing at it, and so mm-hmm. he's kind of dealing with the ashes of good intentions and all.
Yeah, and which I think has been such up through most of through the 90s. Mm-hmm. Basically, my personal X-Men canon,
yes,
really kind of ends at right about Executioner Song.
I could agree.
And then after that, like, I read stuff, and there's been some really enjoyable stories since then. But when I kind of think of as my X-Men, kind mm-hmm. of that's the stopping point. The rest, it's kind of like it's fan fiction, which I mean, it all is, but. You know, those are those pre-Executioner Song stories are the ones that really just, I get giddy just thinking about them. And one of the key things about that is Scott wanting to do the right thing, wanting to do his best, and having to keep those pieces all together, and because of his past, really not knowing how to express or let the emotion out.
Absolutely.
And I think, one of the reasons why that's right, birds. That's exactly right. I'm going to translate. One of the reasons I think the modern day Scott Summers doesn't ring true to me is I think his character has since then been just kind of summed up as he likes to be in charge. He's a Boy Scout and he's kind of a jerk. The yeah. end. And that's never been my Scott Summers.
I hear you. Absolutely. And even the Scott Summers that's around now, it's just there's almost a cold and an arrogant distance, that he has with his, even with his fellow mutants, with with men and all, because I think that they have an uncanny run. I think now, or at least initially, it was like Scott, and there was Magic, and and in particular White Queen, Emma Frost, and Magneto. Even Magneto has kind of been written as almost being in utter disbelief of Scott's extremist tactics now.
Yeah, yeah. I can't really speak bad about what's coming out simply because I haven't been able to enjoy it enough to read it. So I can't kind of point my finger at it because whenever I've read it, it's just been not enjoyable to me. I think Bendis mm-hmm. has some really strong points in his writing style, and he has some weak points. And I think some of those weak points is I've never really enjoyed anything he's done that is above street level.
Yeah.
His Daredevil run, I really enjoyed. A lot of his Ultimate Spider-Man stuff, which is still kind of a street-level view, I've really enjoyed. When True. His new Avengers was kind of Avengers as street-level heroes, it was really super. But then he got into the Secret Wars and the kind of let's tie things and make big concept pieces and blah, 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 blah. I think it goes against all his strengths, and it shows his kind of glaring lack of being able to write characters as they have existed.
That's true, and especially like you mentioned, like with, even like with the Secret War, because you have to, because whenever you're taking on kind of like an expand, whenever you're taking on something like that, it goes beyond street level. It's more of an expansion, and especially like within, you know, within comics, whenever you kind of go over a kind of like a broad scale type of, you know, type of story like yeah. that, your characters have to be fairly well cemented, you know, and just
yeah,
like
yeah. And they have to ring true to what they've been, and I don't feel Bendis ever really tries to make characters ring true. But in X Factor, which you know, one of the big storylines in this is Scott Summers going back to Alaska to find his wife and son, and there's no trace to be found. There's no records. The house is up for sale. Everything's been moved out of it. And he starts hallucinating. Yeah. Which is, you know, it works in the story. It's kind of weird, but it works. He starts seeing visions of his wife, who turns into Jean, who turns into Phoenix, and he's kind of dealing with all the guilt he feels about. He drove his family away. He's responsible for the injuries of Angel. Everything about him is falling apart. And then enter the Master Mold.
Yes. Oh my gosh. And Master Mold. Like, oh my gosh, the sun. Oh, this was the scare. When I think it was issue like 13. Was a horrifying picture.
Oh, yeah.
Image.
When it pulls itself out of the ocean and...
Yeah. And it actually... And it actually even kills some... Kills some onlookers.
Yeah.
Brent, did you ever read Cyclops Retribution? Remember that? It was in Marvel Comics Presents for a bit. It was a couple of issues where Cyclops went to Muir Island.
Is this the one where he kind of fought the Moloids?
I believe so. I think so.
Yeah, yeah. With Ron Lim art.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Oh, it's been years. And I never was able to get the full collection of those.
I intend to remedy that for you, my friend.
Oh, please. But, yeah, I mean, this issue, the... Not only just the storyline of it, but is it possible to say enough good things about Simonson's art?
No, because even in 86, I mean, it's just, for some reason he's able to like, he puts such a great stamp, you know, just like,
oh, he does
on these characters, you know, and like, In fact, I hate to jump back, one thing that, of course, the Simonses are, as I've learned, the Simonses are also well known for their Thor run.
Oh, yes, and I loved
how, and I loved how they were able to kind of cross the Mutant Massacre story into Thor, where Thor is the one who actually finds Angel and brings him back to X Factor, and yet, you know, just in his look, and it's the time when he has the beard, you know.
Oh, I love Simonson's beard Thor with the gaudy but beautiful armor.
Yes, yes. Like, oh my gosh.
I mean, really, Simonson, just his pencils in that, his pencils in this. I think it's Wyacek, Bob Wyacek, who inks over it. It just works so well. Like, Master Mold is a giant sentinel who births sentinels.
Yes.
It is terrifying in these issues. partly because of the story, but a lot just because of those inspired visuals of this giant machine that's falling apart, and there's no real sense of symmetry to it as it hunts down Scott Summers because it's the closest and most powerful mutant in the area.
That's right. And then another thing, too, is that was that there's a couple of police officers who are, you know, who've arrested Scott.
Yeah.
Because they assume that because in the middle of the hallucination, Scott ends up blasting, you know, he and Madeline, Nathan's home.
Yeah.
And so they see it, and there's not to give anything away, but
away. We're spoiling the crap out of this because people need to track this down and read it.
Well, one of the officers, I think around in issue 15, he takes Cyclops to the morgue because they recently had because one of their recent decedents happens to be a once beautiful redhead who was kind of, I think, near the side of the house. And so they're convinced that Cyclops is, is responsible for her death.
Yeah.
Or it's
just confusion. Like, he might be responsible, but because he was already searching for her before they found about him. Like, is this the guy? We don't know. But he's in the middle of a completely just obliterated house. So if nothing else, we need to take him in.
Very much so. And Cyclops is, as the police officers are kind of dealing with that doubt, Cyclops is hell-bent on making sure that they don't die because there have been so many losses at this time.
Yeah.
You know, and so many deaths, and he has some golden lines because I think it was in 14, because matter of fact, I was taking notes, you know, as I was reading. But he's like, I know I can stop him, you know. I would even say that this fight with Master Mold, between Cyclops and Master Mold, in a way, it's almost like the X-Men equivalent to the famous Spider-Man and Juggernaut fight.
Oh, it kind of is, yeah.
Because it's just almost it's like insurmountable odds, and if anything, aside from Master Mold, Cyclops is kind of, he's fighting himself, and he has a vision of Professor
And with those visions of Professor Xavier, mm-hmm. I keep on going back and forth in my head because I can't remember if this is one of those points where Professor X is dead or not. Because there's been so many. I've never quite figured out which do I prefer. Because it's not... Because he's been hallucinating and his hallucinations have been speaking to him, when Professor X shows up and kind of tells him what to do and gives him advice... And Scott is not happy with this, and he keeps on, you know, talking about the pressure of having to be one of Xavier's little soldiers, and he's not that anymore. He's not in his control. And I keep on wondering, like, you know, there's no reason that couldn't really be Professor X.
That's true. That's very true.
And so as this fight with the Master Mold going on, it's also Scott fighting his personal demons, or is he having an argument with the psychically manifested Professor X during this battle? Either way, like, if someone wanted to say, like, no, it's obviously hallucination, sure, but because that's how Professor X, you know, hey, what's up? You're seeing me in your mind. Yeah. There's no reason it couldn't be.
You're right. And one thing that, you know, that I think we both realize is just reading it is, I don't want to jump ahead, is that Cyclops in all ways has kind of been the premier student, you know, like that first student for Xavier, kind of the shining example, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of pressure when you're kind of at the top of the, when you're at the top of the class, and you know, like you said, he mentions, you know, being one of Xavier's little soldiers, and finally, after taking all these orders and seeing some of the losses that have come with it, Like, for example, before, you know, originally, you know, thinking that Jean had died, you know, on the moon as Dark, mm-hmm. as Dark Phoenix, and he finally, you know, he rebels, you know, he's sick of all these, he's sick of all these losses and all this bloodshed, and you know, and probably the biggest, and it seems like the biggest loss for him has been of any kind of hopes at having a family of his own, you know. And he kind of, it's like the son, it's almost like the good son rebelling against the father.
It really is. And both Simonsons, because, you know, the art and the expression and the acting of the characters goes a long way of selling this. But what I really like about it is Louise does a great job of scripting it so that he always, you know, he always sounds true to his character, even when he's kind of enraged and going a little bit out of his mind there. It's still kind of, I can always feel like, no, this makes sense for this character at this time. Yeah. You know, like even just little things of him finding, he starts to actually wonder if his family existed. Was he just making it up and kind of fulfilling his own dream? And then he finds the baby's rattle.
Oh my gosh, yes.
And just his kind of talking about it, you know, like, oh yeah, the baby would always through there and we'd have to, you know, go struggle to find it. And he just, like, you can feel the click in him through the art and through the words of just him being like, no, this exists, this is proof. And it's both the him being like relieved that he found it and that he knows he's not going crazy, and also just the frustration and anger of, yet again, it's people just fucking with him.
That's so true, you know. And on top, you know, and on top of that, you know, these, you know, the cops are, you know, the cops have him in handcuffs.
Yeah.
And like, and they, but he is holding on to it. And honestly, in a way, I was, the way that, you know, the way that they did the smile for him, I smiled a bit for him. Because even in that chaos, you know, he was like, you know what, I've got this, you know, I've got this little avatar here, you know, we're just in the midst of this chaos.
And I think, I feel it's been so long since I've seen Scott also depicted as incredibly capable and incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
And this story manages to show both, just almost seamlessly. Like, even just the little bit of where he doesn't have his visor.
Right.
And, you know, without my visor, I can't control him. Either way, I'm dangerous. But with my visor, I'm harnessed danger.
Oh, that was a fantastic line.
Yeah.
And another part of, and definitely another part of his, you know, of his guilt too, is just in, you know, what's come about with the Morlocks, you know, because although you know, they want to have X-Factor's, you know, base of operations is intended as a sanctuary for them.
Yeah.
As you read along, and while he's in Alaska, Beast in particular and Iceman are having to deal with a kind of crowded house, a crowded house of sometimes some reluctant refugees, if you will.
Yeah.
And then and I remember some of them, I think the point is made, I think it may be by Mask, by the Morlock Mask, that you know, I know you want to, you know, although you want to protect us, look at what happened to Angel. You couldn't even, you know, you couldn't even help him. He's not even, you know, he's lost the thing that really, really made him.
And to go back to one of those issues, X-Factor 11.
Yes.
Which is the one where we get to see, what do they call themselves in this? The Tunnelers,
yes.
Which has Mask and has, one of the things I like about this issue is how many times in, I just feel like in cartoons, in other, like maybe even in some of the movies, we keep getting glimpses of the tunnelers. The girl who turns into the big dragon, Arclight, Scaleface, and Arclight, who I think in the later cartoon got turned into Berserker, who got turned into someone else, and these characters only appear pretty much in this issue, as far as I know, because they show up just to get killed and kind of show more consequences of all that's going on.
You're right in that, and just from this run, they pop so much. That once the green light happened at Fox, all of a sudden they're kind of going to they're kind of going to animation immortality.
Yeah, and again, just to keep singing the praises of Louise, we get two other cops this time in New York, and they're very small players in the issue, but the amount of kind of personality Louise manages to show of the two cops, especially the cop who ends up shooting Scaleface and killing her, and just his like regret and sadness at doing that. We get the Walt art with the cop and the tears in his eyes, and Louise's dialogue of it's so well done. It doesn't feel heavy handed.
Like she's just as Randy says, she's just a little girl. Mm-hmm. But the other cop is trying to cover, be like, hey, she was coming, she was heading our way.
Yeah, no, you, and I mean, this is probably a terrible thing to throw into a podcast of books.
Yeah,
but it does make me kind of think of like, no, look how that person looked. You had to act like it was going to be an immense threat.
Unless you're talking about like the little brother on Clarissa Explains It All, the word Ferguson is pretty much like shit. Pretty much that's some serious Spitfire taboo.
Exactly.
Reading this, just like, and kind of the incident with the cops, it really hit on just, I think maybe what. How you always hear about like sort of like the race relations metaphor that they had originally, like with X-Men and like with Xavier kind of being like the Martin Luther King peaceful coexistence.
Magneto being the more Malcolm X of
exactly
the only way to live together is to live apart.
Exactly, even in that early kind of militant approach, you're so right. I mean, was able to capture it. She captured that, that pathos brilliantly with the, the police officer. Oh gosh, but it's just a marvelous run, and even without Xavier, it hits on kind of just the prejudices that mutants have to go through.
And what's so great is it's. Even though, I mean, we've been talking about a lot of the heavy stuff, even though it's very quick, but there is definitely stuff in there that reads race relations, hate groups, people who have to feel they have to hide who they are or don't feel they're treated the same based on appearance. But then, a few panels later, an issue later, you just have silly hijinks. The whole Boom Boom issue is just—it's just great.
It's delightful, it's fun to, and it's kind of fun to see, because Hank and Bobby, I almost want to consider them almost sort of like not like a second tier, but almost kind of like somewhat of an alternate to Johnny Storm Johnny Storm and Ben Grimm.
Oh yeah, totally. They got. I can't say a similar relationship, but they have a similar bond. But they don't have the antagonism that Johnny and Ben do. They have that same brotherly bond, but It's more playful teasing rather than playful, I'm going to throw a brick at your head.
Exactly, and I love how, you know, how Ice was like, okay, it was like, when Beast was like, well, how are you going to train her? I think she's just fine, and then Iceman's like, I don't want to train her, I want to kill her.
Yep. And just the how it keeps on following up in the other issues of Boom Boom having a totally crush on the dreamy Bobby and not liking Hank at all, and yet she keeps on getting thrown into places with Hank.
It's too funny.
Yeah.
Oh gosh, it's hilarious. And honestly, going through this run, it made me think that, like, I think that the Angel is somewhat kind of underrated, because folks like to look at the, you know, at his flight power, and there's the eventual, you know, conversion into Archangel,
yeah.
which really helps to kind of cement his importance and, you know, and just the power of transition within, you know, within, but it did, and it really didn't hit me, because, like I said, I hadn't read the first couple of issues in a while, but X-Factor was initially his idea, and he's kind of dealing with, you know, and this is where, and this is like our good host was saying earlier, the kind of the muddle confusion between X-Factor and the X-Terminators. He deals with that, and
yeah.
He's got to admit that it's like, you know, it was
a pretty crappy idea.
Yes, it was.
It was okay. We're going to be X-Factor, which I'll go ahead and say it now, since we've talked enough about the comic. Right. Hopefully, people who are still listening will just bear with it. X-Factor will be the public front, which are mutants posing as humans, so society thinks they're humans, who are tracking down and capturing, possibly eliminating, dangerous mutants. But they have their alter egos, Exterminators, which are mutant terrorists who have a different color scheme. I forget how early in the series this got introduced, but it doesn't really survive, you know, a year of publishing time. And kind of a lot of it is just done of like, wait a minute, this is ridiculous. And and it sets up the evilness of Cameron Hodge.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Goodness. And he is just, and I mean, he doesn't quite give it away here, but, you know, he's just, did you ever watch Gargoyles?
I watched the first year, maybe, and then it became impossible to find on TV. I hear it's great, just the whole thing.
It was incredible. It was like a retirement home for all the Star Trek Next Generation cast.
Yeah.
But I remember that, like, you know, like the main bad guy, like, the main antagonist, like Xanatos.
Yeah. The businessman guy?
Yes. He had, right, his assistant, like the blonde businessman guy. That's what Cameron Hodge kind of reminds me of, you know, at the get-go. Because he's just, I mean, because he's the quote-unquote kind of ace, I think, in, you know, in Warren, X-Factor's whole.
Mm-hmm.
But that is not to be as you, you know, as you indicated.
Yeah, no, and he just... It's such a slow build to that, you know, and where he always kind of gives that weird vibe, but, you know, it isn't until maybe he really kind of gets Warren's wings cut off. But if he didn't get Warren's wings cut off, then, you know, Warren would have died. So even that's kind of understandable.
That's very true.
And speaking of Warren, issue 15.
Oh my gosh! Yes.
Has his wings amputated.
Yes.
And decides that life without being Angel is not a life he wants.
Oh my gosh!
And takes his private jet, flies it out, and it explodes. He blows it up. And because, since, to turn it back into the Scott Summers Love Fest,
Yep,
since
yep.
Scott was in Alaska all during this, and he was told Angel needs him, one of his oldest friends needs him, but he's like, I got to put my family together. And then he kind of realizes that X-Factor is as much his family as anyone else. He comes back to New York just in time to be too late. And blames himself.
Yes. And he doesn't hold back on it, you know. It's interesting seeing how in that love triangle, kind of seeing, and Louise gives a great point of view, gives great, you know, points of view, for Scott and for Warren, because they're both kind of feeling guilty about their attraction to Gene, because how it's going to affect the other. They're kind of going off of body language, you know, and things, and even Warren's like Candy Southern, you know, sees Warren and Gene, hugging it out.
It's definitely a moment.
Yes.
He can deny what that moment was all he wants. That was a moment.
So true, so true.
I'm going to give the art a very strange compliment.
Go for it.
I think I could look at pictures of Walt Simonson drawing characters throwing stacks of paper all day.
Yes.
This happens in several issues. You know, Candy Southern throws the file full of papers. Warren throws this thing of newspapers. And it just, every time he does it, it looks great.
That's true.
Like, I don't know how it's entertaining.
Oh my gosh. When did Dennis Miller start on SNL?
Ooh, that's, I don't know.
I think there might be a correlation because Weekend Update, he was a master at, tossing the papers. Simonson, Dennis Miller, I don't know.
Conspiracy? Man, but I haven't seen Louise Simonson write anything recently. Do you know if she's still active?
You know, I'm not sure now that you mention it. I mean, honest to goodness, I think she certainly should be. I don't know, maybe she's gotten into. I could see her, maybe doing like novels or something. But she should be around.
I mean, I want to say I've read something by her, like, but it was still a couple of years ago, and I can't remember what it was. And I know Simonson stays busy. Yeah. He drew some Hulk issues, and now he's. If anyone listening to this has not picked up Simonson's Ragnarok, which I think is through IDW, oh my goodness, it's only has two issues out, but it's everything great about Simonson. Mm-hmm. He hasn't missed a step. Just the storytelling, the pacing, the art, it's matured like good whiskey.
Oh my goodness! Oh,
and I just, as a kid, I actually had a slightly difficult time, because of their line work and because of other things. I mean, now it's a lot easier, but of telling the difference between Art Adams and Simonson. Because they had that kind of cartoony but realistic and lots of lines. Again, this was less than 10 years old, but I just, both of them, Art Adams in Longshot and Simonson here.
They just had such sharp, refined sketch work,
Lots of little lines, not much cross-hatching, but really detailed. And cartoony, but realistic at the same, and just great storytelling.
And they were able to Walt's able to just like you said earlier, he's able to just kind of like nail the trace. I think it's like issue 10, because it was like Marvel's, was it like 25th anniversary where the issues would have the borders around the borders of the front page.
Issue 10 here of X Factor.
Yeah, And you have, like, and Cyclops is looking kind of stoic and serious.
Yeah, that frown. Then,
And then you've got, and Jean is, and you know, you have Jean, of course, with that, you know, that Medusa-like mane of hair. Just that.
The cover to issue 13 of Jean with the hair that turns into, she's in the Dark Phoenix uniform, and her hair is kind of turning into the fiery Phoenix, and there's the different, maybe that's a Madeline Pryor behind her, maybe it's Jean, and the other, it's just, I know, I'm not sure if hearing an episode where it's just two guys talk about how great this series of comics are, I'm not sure how, if that's the most interesting thing in the world, but really, really, I think these are some of the comics, it's some of the best the art form has offered, and I think it's a shame that, you know, there's not a good collection of these. I mean, these first 20 issues, even though the first couple before the Simonsons take it over, not the best. Issues of, what, 1, 2, and 3, maybe even 4?
That's you know, right, yeah.
But once the Simonsons get on it, oh, there's so much life in these. There needs to be an omnibus. If nothing else, tie it into the fact that it's Apocalypse's appearance. And all through these issues, there's the backstory of Apocalypse collecting mutants.
That's right. And matter of fact, that's another thing, is that you have such great character dynamics, but yet you have a villain like Apocalypse who obviously, especially like even in the cinematic, you know, world is taking a greater presence.
Yeah.
He almost takes a back seat, you know, when you look at how this
Well, because I mean he hasn't done anything until this. I think he'd been like a guy in the background. I mean, it might be his first, him taking Pestilence, who had just laid out Sabretooth, might be one of his first direct actions as a character. And it's so well. One of the things I also love about this time period of comics is I really do feel the fact that each issue, I mean, there's connected storytelling, don't get me wrong, but each issue kind of tells a complete story or feels like actual real progress. But there's also, you know, a nice arc being laid out. Like, it's so well done, and I feel, because of decompressed storytelling, I mean, you might read one comic that just doesn't feel as fulfilling as these do. You know?
Yeah, just they hold up. I mean, they really do hold up so well on their own. And it's, you know, it's just, there was such a, and it's just, when I would go through, and I was tempted to read more and more, but each issue could kind of edify you. Just like,
yeah, wow. Exactly. It's so hard to put these down because each issue tells you just enough where you get that satisfying bite. And you know, it's kind of like the potato chips. Oh, I could read one more. I could just read. No, you know, I mean, that was good. I could have one more.
That's so true. That's
so. Where do you think? I mean, we've talked about this is a great period for Scott Summers. Where do you think? Where did it all go wrong?
Oh gosh. Well, you know, we were just talking. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I'm not going to be able to have the Scott Summers Love Fest any other time, so I'm going to take advantage of it. We're going to have a longer episode, I feel.
You know, I'm going to say, like, because I remember we were talking, I think, like, that once the more, all due respect for Morrison, but I think that was when it really started to kind of, that's when it started to hit the, you know, no pun intended, but the skids.
Yeah,
if you will. Yeah, that was when it.
He
really
hits skids, but she's just a minor character in these issues. She's got a force field.
That's right. But yeah, I think that was when it really, that was definitely a marking point. Ironically enough, I noticed that, like, in the Master Mold issue, like, when Master Mold mentions, you know, Scott being one of the being one of the 12.
Yeah.
And then that comes in, and then that, of course that comes in like later, kind of later on, later on in the X-Men run, where Cyclops, in order to protect the Ultimate Universe, the Age of Apocalypse universe, Nate Gray, he ends up merging with Apocalypse, and then he comes back, and I think in like they do a Search for Cyclops miniseries, and I think there's a storyline called Eve of Extinction, where he comes back, and he's even like kind of, he's almost somewhat kind of buddy buddy with Wolverine on a covert mission. But really, I think that Morrison run was what kind of put the nail in the coffin. The whole thing with the, you know, with the White Queen, with Emma Frost. And,
no, I gotta agree with you on pretty much all fronts there, because I don't know, like. I know Morrison is the comic world darling, and I've definitely read some Morrison stuff I've enjoyed.
Sure.
But I think, like, you know, and I can kind of understand this style of writing, but it almost seems he said, like, why let characterization stand in the way of what I want to write? Mm-hmm. And I don't think it really reads that well. I think there's a lot of changes. There's a lot of lack of characterization in general. It's almost like, well, you know how these characters are, and you know how they should be concerned, so I'm not even going to bother telling you, like, letting you see how these characters feel about things. Right. It's just kind of like, leave it up to your own imaginations. And also, I just felt like the Morrison run, in general, I felt almost anything other than Cassandra Nova, who... But almost anything that the big events that Morrison did had already pretty much been done by Claremont. It was let's make the Claremont run, but with, you know, Frank Quietly art, which is, you know, I mean, Frank Quietly is a quite a talented man.
Indeed.
Yeah. I feel like I'm whimpering out just because we went from talking about how awesome these issues were to just kind of like, I wish this Cyclops could come back.
I know, just like this, just, you know, he's really in a dark age, you know, a dark age right now, you know. Yeah.
Here's another thing I think.
Go ahead.
Wolverine is the sexier character.
Agreed. You know, agreed.
And I think, to keep Wolverine being sexy, to make him be able to do everything, he started to do these stories and get the action that would have been Cyclops's. You know, I mean, because now it's Wolverine kind of keeping the dream alive and doing this. And I get the fact that, oh no, that's supposed to be an inversion to show that blah, da, blah, da, blah, blah, blah. But it's just like, no, really, you want the guy who's played by Hugh Jackman to be in everything and to be able to do everything. And if in order to make that story happen, you have to basically detract from Scott Summers, which has been so poorly written for decades. Mm-hmm. I mean, why not? But
it's just they want to give the cover boy more coverage, you know.
Yeah, stupid cover boy. Well, because I don't want this to turn into the Wolverine hate podcast, but the Scott Summers love fest, I'm gonna pull the plug on us.
All right, fair enough.
Where can they find you on the net, Sean?
Oh, man, thank you so much. I'll be glad to tell you. You can find me at scpolite.podomatic.com. I do a podcast called Beast from the East, also known as Toyo Kanon. It is a podcast dedicated to the music of Japan. We focus more so on kind of like the underground music, but we go through all genres: pop, rock, jazz, hip hop, shoegaze, reggae, all, all that and more. But originally, I did Beast from the East as a terrestrial radio show here in Athens at the University of Georgia, and I did that for 2 years, and then back in 2012, I started a podcast on the Podomatic channel. There have been a bit of delays right now because I've been doing some stage work. But we're still keeping going strong, and as Brent, as you can attest to, you know, there's a lot of fantastic music out there. And people would be even surprised that the talent is not necessarily native to Japan. It's not necessarily native to Japan. There's a lot of bands that have folks who've come from other countries to find root there on the phone, and it's quite amazing. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, and I think if you're looking for music from Japan, I think that type of podcast. Yeah, I'm talking to the listeners now. This type of podcast, that's what you need to find out, because one of my big complaints about music in Japan so far is unless you have a guide to like point you out to where all the cool stuff is happening, a lot of what's out there is just commercially the same. And there's a lot of cool stuff happening, but almost all that you can easily find is going to be some version of idol rock or AKB or Arashi or something like that. Go check out Beast from the East. Is it on iTunes?
Yes, it is. Beast from the East is on iTunes.
All right, so check it out on Podomatic. Check it out on iTunes and find some cool music.
Definitely. And if I can I give a couple shout outs?
Give shout outs.
Okay, terrific. Actually, there's a couple of fine folks kind of in the Tokyo area. There's Tom Oleski, stuntman manager, promoter extraordinaire. There's also another good friend of mine, April Ferreto. She is the centerpiece of a promotions company called Inter Idoru, and they're also on Facebook, and you can find them on the Beast from the East Facebook page as well.
Excellent. But,
they're really great. Keeping the music strong.
Keep the music strong, and if you got the shout out and you want to talk comic books, give me a shout.
Oh, no doubt about it. No doubt about it. And Brandon, this has been an absolute pleasure, sir.
Oh man, it's been great having you on. Yeah, and we'll stick around for me and you have a little powwow after the show.
Sounds like a winner.
Excellent. Well, thank you for listening. As always, you can find me, my little fictions, my basically comic book reviews at deadlytroubadour.com. In the show notes, you can find ways to buy things, probably the essential volume of X-Factor, through Amazon, either in the U.S. or in Japan. If you follow those links and purchase one of those, then a tiny bit of that comes my way from Amazon, not from you. From you, but, the money doesn't go up. Just a little bit of what you pay comes back to me. Also, yeah, that's good. Go check out Beast from the East. Go check out my site. And go read some comics, because there's a lot of good stuff out there.
Yes, indeed. With X-Factor, and you can even say it with some titles kind of like with Aquaman and is that like Peter David, like once he kind of gets his talons on a title, it ends up getting that more often, or even Incredible Hulk, it gets more often than not a, like kind of like a favorable kind of a favorable rehaul, you know.
But he
becomes the person most kind of associated with it. He's like a Joss Whedon before Joss Whedon.
I still don't know really what I'm doing.
Oh no. That's how you got to start though.